I will call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum, so we'll go back to the minutes. But we do have a great opportunity to try to understand from Dr. Tom Melcher and Deputy Commissioner Chaz Anderson what is going on with the stimulus package as it relates to K-12 education funding. So we're going to hear their presentation, and we have the whole committee hearing to ask them questions and gain information, which we really need because we have to find out, we have to keep track of it, know what's going on, how it interrelates to what we're doing, and also see if there's anything that the legislature should be doing in terms of working with the governor. When we did have a streaming video conference of this for the Fiscal and Planning Commission, or whatever that is called, last week, the National Conference on State Legislatures told us that the governors around the country kind of beat out or won out over the legislatures around the country in terms of which of the two have the more decision making, but we, you know, I still think the legislatures need to be fully informed and do what we can. So with that, I think we have two of the best people here to tell us what they know, so please come up. Do we have a quorum yet?
No.
Okay. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the tape, and whichever order you're going to speak, you got your PowerPoint up there. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chaz Anderson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department. Dr. Melcher and I will be going through the PowerPoint and can take questions as we go along or at the end, however you prefer.
Well, what we like to do is take questions as we go along, and then if it turns out we look like we're not going to make it through, we halt that process and let you finish and then go back to questions. But for starters, let's go with questions as we go along.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, we'll start out with the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, and there are several different pots of money, so it can be kind of confusing because at times we're using the same formula to distribute different pots of money, so we'll try to be as clear as possible and first start out with what's called the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund. Congress has made available about $53.6 billion to states. Minnesota's share is approximately $821.4 million. I will put a caveat on all these numbers, they're estimates only. We'll have updated numbers as we move along, but this is our estimated portion of the funding. The money was distributed to states as such. 61% is based on a state's relative population for children ages 5 through 24. 39% was based on the overall relative population. The law requires the governor allocate at least 81.8% of the money to support elementary, secondary, and post-secondary education, and as applicable to early childhood education programs and services. That 81.8% is a minimum. The governor could allocate 100% to those provisions, but that is the minimum what he needs to allocate to those areas.
And one thing that, as we go along, and maybe it's in here that I'm interested in, and maybe it's too early to tell, but the fact that all these funds are tied in with early childhood, K-12, and higher ed, I'm particularly interested in, you know, how can we separate out, or when can we know how much is going to K-12?
Sure. Madam Chair, to answer that question just broadly, you'll see sort of the different parameters, at least for the State Stabilization Fund, as it involves the three different areas. First, if you go to the next slide, the governor first must use the funds for 1 through 3. The first one is restoring an FY09, 10, 11, the level of state support for education that's greater of fiscal 2008 to 2009. Number two is allow existing state funding increases to support elementary and secondary education for the funding increases that were adopted prior to October 1st of 2008. And then the third one involves higher education, provided in 09, 10, and 11, the amount of funds to public institutions of higher education in the state that is needed to restore state support for higher education to the levels of fiscal year 08 and 09.
Are those in priority order?
Those are, yes, the three that they must fulfill first.
Number one is for all three levels of education.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then two and three are the next two priorities.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, in K-12 education, we did not have any reductions in funding, so first, and then it really involves what, to the extent reductions are proposed or have occurred in higher education, and then what sort of money is left over. Our expectation is the governor would lay that out in his revised budget recommendations that will be out shortly after the March 3rd budget forecast. Now, if the governor determines that the amount of funds to cover 1 through 3 is not sufficient or is insufficient, the amount of 1 through 3 is proportionate to the relative shortfall. So in this case, we think that won't be the case in Minnesota. We'll have available funds left over, so we don't expect number 1 to carry out. And so we go down to, after carrying out 1 through 3, the remaining funds are provided to local education agencies or school districts and charter schools, that's the federal language for that term, based on their relative share of the funding under Title I Part A. So school districts and charter schools will receive the remaining allocation based on the Title I formula that's used under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act.
Can any of these funds go to private schools, any in this category or any category?
Madam Chair, as a member of the committee, it's my understanding no, but I'll clarify that.
There is a prohibition.
There is a prohibition, yes.
Okay, thank you. That was for the tape from Dr. Melcher.
Moving on actually to allowable uses of by local education agencies or school districts and charters, they may use the funds under the state fiscal stabilization fund for allowable activities under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or otherwise known as No Child Left Behind, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act, or any modernization, renovation, or repair of public school facilities, including the modernization, renovation, and repairs that are consistent with the recognized green building rating system. We do have some very specific prohibitions on funding for school districts and charters. They cannot use state fiscal stabilization fund for payment of maintenance costs for stadiums or other facilities primarily used for athletic contests and events, or events that with admissions is charged to the general public. They cannot use it for purchases or upgrades of vehicles or improvements of standalone facilities whose purpose is not to educate children but rather to serve as a central office or logistical support facility.
One question I have, going back to the stabilization fund that can be used for modernization, renovation, repair of school facilities. Last year in this committee we had, and we've had other years too, the Wells School that has really terrible buildings. They can't pass a bond, and they don't, with the way debt service equalization has atrophied, they couldn't pass it when they did have it, but now they're really stuck when they don't really have much of it. With that school, they've already contacted me, would that school be a qualifier for this type of revenue, and what would be the process for deciding on one school like that?
Madam Chair, without specifically looking at the requests from that school, if they're renovating the buildings or modernizing it, it seems to me it would qualify for funds. If it's just for ongoing maintenance, that would be a prohibition of funds under the provisions. We expect we'll get more guidance from the U.S. Department of Education as to what sort of parameters will be put on this funding. Later I'll talk about, at the end, there's a lot of reporting requirements, especially on this particular provision as to how local school districts spent funds for modernizing or repairing buildings. So we'd have to take a look at what the U.S. Department of Education is providing us with guidance and then their actual proposal.
And then do they give us guidance on the pecking order, or is that up to the Department of Education?
Madam Chair, as the funds flow to the local districts, they have to, it's up to their discretion and their local school boards how to spend the funds as allowed under the parameters of the law. So
in other words, they would not be applying for this. They would just get their share and could use it as they were they decided.
Madam Chair, that's correct, as allowed under the law.
Okay, thank you.
Going on to the next slide, under the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, the governor is required to submit an application formally to the Secretary of Education. In the application, the governor must assure that the state has met effort for elementary and secondary education in fiscal years 9, 10, and 11, at least to such levels as fiscal year 6. Maintain effort for higher education in fiscal years 9, 10, and 11, as such as the level was in 2006. Improve equity in teacher distribution under the Education and Elementary and Secondary Education Act This is an annual report the department is required to do under No Child Left Behind. It's ensuring basically that we have highly qualified teachers in our classroom, particularly in our highest need schools. We're required to assure that we're improving collections and use of data under the America Competes Act. Specifically, Minnesota's meeting that requirement and is ahead of most states in implementing a data longitudinal system. Next, the state needs to assure that it's enhancing the quality of statewide assessments and complying with rules related to the inclusion of children with disabilities and limited English proficient students in the assessments and providing those accommodations. We believe we've met that requirement in having a fully approved testing program as of summer of 2008. It was approved. The state must improve academic content standards and student achievement academic standards consistent with the America Competes Act. Again, Minnesota is ahead of the curve here. We just completed a revision and adoption of our new math standards, which would meet that requirement, and we're currently working on our science standards.
Are there any other standards besides math and science in America Competes?
The America Competes Act focuses on STEM education and math and science education, so it's our understanding those are those two areas that require states to improve their academic standards in those core subject areas. Next, we have to ensure compliance with schools in needs of improvement. This shows a lot of sections of the federal law, but basically what that is that meeting the requirement that we're providing technical assistance to those schools that have been identified as needs improvement under No Child Left Behind.
Thank you. Representative Markford has a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm sorry this was a few slides back, but I've been thinking about this, and getting back to the governor's use of the state fiscal stabilization fund, and that first part where he must restore funds at least back to the greater of 08 or 09 levels.
We're on slide number 3.
So that would be slide, yes, number 3. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, could the governor, in his supplemental budget, cut education-based spending by, let's say, $400 million, but then use the stabilization funds to replace that $400 up to 09 levels? My fear, if that would be the case, is when all is said and done, you'd wind up in the future with a lower base for education without the revenues coming in future years, and which would be disaster. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering if that's a use for these type of funds, if the governor would have that discretion to do something like that.
We hope not. Let's ask. But Dr. Melcher?
Madam Chair and Representative Markquart, we believe this calculation is based on what the governor recommends and what the legislature ends up doing in fiscal year 2010. So this is something that's kind of a moving target depending on what the policy changes are. So there could theoretically be reductions in education spending that have not yet been approved. There are some in higher ed, for example, that have been proposed that could then affect the distribution of funding between K-12 and higher education under this bill.
Madam Chair. Representative Markquart.
Well, my real concern is, of course, with all of this federal stimulus stuff, it's one-time funding. But even be doubly worse if you were lowering bases in education or other areas and supplanting that one time with this, because when the stimulus leaves, then you're just left with less education funding in the future with no revenues to cover. I mean, we need to be very, very careful, and I think there's a lot of unknowns here and a lot of power that the governor has in all of this. And it's an area that we need to keep very close tabs on, because this federal stimulus stuff is going to be here one time. It doesn't fix our budget into the future, and we just have to make sure we protect base funding in these areas. So
I think it's a very, very good caution, and maybe we could ask Ms. Anderson, Deputy Commissioner Anderson, if you could think if you think the governor's likely to be thinking along those lines, or is he going to not and stick with his story?
Madam Chair, Representative Markquart, I can assure you that the governor is thinking about a four-year outlook, not just a two-year outlook. And as you'll see through this proposal and special education and the Title I funding, this is all based on two-year funding. So, you know, we have to look at an outlook of 4 years when we look at the budget and trying to balance it. And we're going to be very, reticent to these core services in education and finance that with one-time money, and I think local school districts will tell you the same thing. The other issue that we have that's a little complex is that if the money left over is required to go out to school districts under the Title I formula, which isn't the same distribution as the general education formula. So there's some other inequities that are created if you try to do that as well. So we understand the complexity of the issue and share your concerns and trying to figure out what our plan will be.
And for members new to the committee, new to the legislature, just so everybody knows, Dr. Melcher is the nonpartisan staff, and Commissioner Anderson works for the governor. So if we want facts, we could ask either one of them. But if we want them to be nonpartisan facts, we ask Dr. Melcher. And if we want to ask what is the governor likely to do, Dr. Melcher cannot answer that, but Commissioner Anderson can. So Representative Anzell.
I just phoned my answer. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, I think that right now we're on the maintenance of effort issue, which Dr. Melcher will go through.
Slide number 9, members.
And Madam Chair, just to quickly go back to slide number 7, you'll see that the first bullet was that as a condition of receiving the state fiscal stabilization fund, the state has to maintain efforts for elementary and secondary education in 2009, 2010, and 2011. At least up to the level of 2006. And so one of the issues that we run into is exactly how do we define state support? That doesn't appear to be defined in the bill. We're waiting for some additional guidance on that. I do have a chart in the packet that you received that's labeled state support for elementary and secondary education. It's a kind of a half page one. I'm not sure if I can get that to project on here, what this does is to show what the calculations would look like under a couple of different scenarios. And I'm not sure if you all have that too. Okay. So what this shows is that on the top line, we're showing the aid entitlement. That's the amount of money that school districts generate under the formula on a 100% funding basis. And our preference and the way that we've calculated maintenance of effort in the past has been to define state support based on aid entitlement. And so under that kind of a concept, we look at the state aid to schools, we also look at the Department of Education budget, the Faribault, Perfect School, all of the things that the state's doing to support elementary and secondary education, add them up, and we get the $6,412,000,000 in 2006. So that would be the minimum to qualify to use the stabilization revenue. But there are other ways of looking at this, and we've had questions raised about what's the proper way to do this, and will the feds have some expectation as to how we do that? So there are two other theoretical possibilities, one being to use state appropriations, excluding SHIFs, and the other would be to use state appropriations, including SHIFs. And if we were to use state appropriations, including SHIFs, it would create some very difficult problems for us for two reasons. One of them is, as you'll see in the fiscal 2006 column, we paid back $607 million in SHIFs in fiscal year 2006. So if we were to use appropriations including SHIFs in the calculation, then we'd have our base kind of artificially inflated by $607 million because of the fact that we had done some tax shift and some aid shift back in the 2003 session that we paid back in 2006, which happens to be the year the feds have picked for the base. And that would then create a base of $6.9 billion. So if we fast forward here to 2009, 2010, and 2011, and we look at the lower portion of the table, which is the increases, under current law, we would meet the maintenance of effort requirements under any of the different scenarios. In other words, we are on an aid entitlement basis. Our aid entitlements are in the $560 to $660 million range, higher than they were in 2006. On appropriations, excluding SHIFs, again, we're more than $600 million over the 2006 base. But if we use appropriations, including SHIFs, then we only have a $23 million cushion under current law. So it really narrows the margin in terms of any sorts of recommendations. And if you go over to the governor's recommendation, which includes $1.25 billion of aid payment and a property tax SHIFs, then we would be $1,176,000,000 short of meeting maintenance of effort. So that if that were the measure used to calculate maintenance of effort, we would not qualify for the federal economic stimulus aid of $821 million. So we've got a real issue here in terms of defining what the proper way is to calculate this. As I said, for our internal calculations in terms of federal maintenance of effort, we've always used aid entitlements, and we hope that's what we can use. But we don't want to be in a situation where we assume that's okay and the Fed's coming on at us 2 years from now and say, pay back $821 million. So we think there needs to be some more research into
this. Well, it sounds like on this committee, we're with you. Commissioner Anderson, is that what the governor's thinking as well?
Yes, we would, Madam Chair, we're going to propose using the aid entitlements as we do with special education. It's very consistent. The federal government has accepted that as part of our state maintenance of effort for special education. So at this point, that's what we plan to use. We'll request additional guidance to ensure that we're not in a situation of having to repay $821 million in the future, but we do know this is an issue that needs to be resolved as soon as possible.
Well, if it's ever helpful for the legislature to help you out reinforcing that point, please call up on us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Dr. Meltzer, please continue. Are we on 9 now? Or?
Yeah, I'd like to move on to slide. Slide 9 was, wait a minute. Oops, sorry, wrong way. Okay. So, slide 9 is kind of a summary of the discussion we just had, that if the calculations are done using aid entitlements or appropriations excluding SHIP, we don't have an issue of maintenance of effort. Theoretically, the legislature or the governor could make substantial reductions and still meet the maintenance effort targets, but again, that raises issues, both in the current biennium and down the road. If the calculations are done using the appropriations, including SHIP, then we've got a whole different set of issues. The next thing I'd like to talk briefly about is a maintenance of effort waiver. The state fiscal stabilization fund does have a provision that allows states or local education agencies to receive a waiver from maintenance of effort requirements, but it's a very high standard to meet, and quite frankly, my assessment is that we would have difficulty doing that. The first requirement is that the state or local education agency must have experienced a precipitous decline in financial resources. We don't have precipitous defined, but I think most people would view that as being a pretty drastic drop in the level of funds available. The second one is that the state would have to maintain education spending as a percentage of the state budget from the preceding year. And we know that there's been a trend in terms of the overall general fund budget toward some slight reduction in the portion going to K-12 as a result of growth in human service budgets, et cetera. So that's another issue that would have to be looked at if we were to try to do this waiver. If we were eligible for a waiver, the state or local education agency could treat any funds received under the fiscal stabilization plan as non-federal funds for the MOE requirement, but it would only work for 1 year. So then we'd be, you know, if we went through this and we found out we were eligible, we could kind of delay 1 year what the issues would be, but it's not a permanent fix.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next slide is the state incentive grants. This is part of the state fiscal stabilization fund. About $4.35 billion will be available to states. The governor has to submit a separate application to the Secretary of Education. Each state that receives a state incentive grant must use half of that money to distribute it to schools under the Title I Part A formula. The other half of that would be competitive based on criteria set by the state in its application to the Secretary.
One thing, and you don't have to answer right now, but I would like to put a bug in your ear to put a bug in the governor's ear. When we got some information from the Education Commission of the state, they gave an example of the for state incentive grants, their interpretation that a good example would be what the state of Maryland is doing with, or what they did rather, with their, it's starting out in 2002, they had what is sounded similar to me, very similar to our new Minnesota Miracle, where they had accountability and some of their funding was based on that, and then they seriously funded over three bienniums new funding for schools, and they actually doubled or tripled how much funding they were giving, and of course they're a small state. And then by doing that and changing some of the things that they were doing, which sounds similar to the path of education reforms that we are on in this state through the governor's office and the legislature, with math and reading, one of the topics was the achievement gap was close 49%, and the other one 51%. And they got, by doing reforms and funding, you know, some people want to do just funding and no reform, and some want to do reform and no funding. But by doing both, they closed half of their achievement gap for math and reading in a very short amount of time. And so I wonder if you could get back to us and find out if the governor would be interested in looking at something like that, tying reforms and money with getting started anyway with some of the state incentive grant money, and looking at, since he's president of the Education Commission of the states, I'm sure he got the same material that I got as a commissioner of that group. And you know, I just was very excited to read it and wondered if we couldn't sort of dovetail on, you know, we have a terrible situation with a deficit and then having to take this one-time money, but if we can somehow, you know, make lemonade out of it, and all of us, you know, QComp, it sounded like, would be a qualification, and, you know, a variety of things. It seems to me there's at least something exciting about this money.
Madam Chair, we'll certainly look into that. I know a little bit about what Maryland's doing, but definitely we'll take a look at that and get back to you.
Thank you.
Going into the next slide, I'm not going to go over these one by one because these are the same assurances from the state fiscal stabilization fund that the governor must make when submitting an application for a state incentive grant. I just went over those assurances. The second area of funding is the Innovative Fund. This is also funding that's available as part of the $53 billion for the state fiscal stabilization fund. It allows the Secretary of Education to reserve up to $650 million to establish an innovative fund to recognize eligible entities. Eligible entities include local education agencies or local school districts and charter schools, or a partnership between a nonprofit organization and either one or more local education agencies or a consortium of schools. It appears to us in legislation that those local entities would directly apply for funding under parameters set by the Secretary of Education. The Secretary is required to award entities that have made significant gains in closing the achievement gap, exceeded the state's measurable objectives for two or more years, or have demonstrated success in significantly increasing academic achievement in all groups of students, made significant improvement in other areas such as graduation rates, increased recruitment and retention of high-quality teachers and school leaders, as demonstrated by meaningful data, and they have established partnerships with the private sector, and the private sector is providing matching funds for this initiative. In addition, the work from the Innovative Fund must allow eligible entities to expand their work and to serve as models for best practices, allow eligible entities to work in partnership with the private sector and philanthropic community, and identify and document best practices that can be shared and brought to scale. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to go now into the second pot of money. So we've left the state fiscal stabilization fund. That was the overview of that fund. The next area of funding is additional monies under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. This is the Title I, Title II, and other related programs. Minnesota is estimated to receive $87 million under Title I, Part A. That formula is based on census data that is distributed to districts, and then districts allocate those funds among their schools based on free and reduced lunch counts. That is available to hire teachers, instructional aides, and other related educational services to students in those schools. The second area of funding is Title II, Part B. That is the Enhancing Technology funding. About $5.8 million is available to the state. This is a competitive process for local school districts to apply for funding, and it's used to enhance technology and related services in schools. The third piece is the McKinney-Vento funding. This estimated at $612,000. This funding is competitive to local school districts to provide services to homeless students. This is an estimate because the amount of money we receive will be based on the number of homeless students we had during the 07-08 school year. That data is still being finalized. The fourth area is school improvement funding. This is also competitive to local school districts and assists schools that are in need of improvement and far along in the process where they're close to restructuring or having to do corrective action, and it provides those schools with additional funds to implement their school improvement plan.
Okay, and a question from Representative Penfeld.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first bullet, Title I, Part A, funding $87 million, the formula. I heard you mention free and reduced. Are there any other factors in the formula? And would you conclude that this one tilts toward poor students, districts that are poor? And then the last bullet, competitive to local districts and assist schools in need of improvement, can the case be made that this pot of money be used in connection with those 14 or 15 districts in Minnesota that are in statutory operating debt and definitely in need of improvement of all kinds?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anzalk, the formula is based on first allocations are sent to states based on their census data for the relative population of school-aged children.
Okay.
Then what we do is we distribute that money, again, based on census data in the district. And then the district makes the allocations to the sites based on free and reduced lunch. And so some of this is somewhat discretionary at the local school boards, but they could decide if they had a higher need in their school improvement plan for one school over another school that they would allocate funding that way. So at least in terms of when we turn over the money, what we look for is does it match their school improvement plans that they've submitted to the state? Is it allowable expenditures under federal law? And so there is quite a bit of discretion about how that's budgeted with the local school district. As it relates to the school improvement funding, this is a relatively new area of funding. About 2 years ago, the federal government created this fund. Minnesota applied, it was a competitive to states. Minnesota applied and was one of 10 states to receive funding. What our plan is that we've targeted funds to those schools in corrective action or that have not made adequate yearly progress for two or more years, and to try to implement a plan to correct the situation or to help restructure the school. For those schools in statutory operating debt, they can certainly apply for that from the state. It really depends really on their academic performance, not necessarily their financial situation, but the additional funds, in some cases, the stabilization fund, the Title I funding may help assist with their financial situation at least for 2 years.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, with regards to Title I funding, historically, in federal government programs where they're keying it off of income data, it's been bad for Minnesota because we're considered to be a wealthy state. Those funding mechanisms tend to reward places like Mississippi, Alabama, the Deep South, places that have much lower incomes and much higher percentages of kids in poverty and much higher percentages of people who are low income. I know it's very early in this process, but the overall education umbrella, are we seeing those characteristics manifesting itself both in the stabilization fund and also in the funding act, where we're seeing Minnesota, for lack of a better way of putting it, not getting a proportional amount of the resources that are allocated?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, one of the problems Minnesota has, which is why we may lose a congressional seat, is just we're not growing as fast as other states in terms of population. The population growth in the South and the West are increasing much faster than the Midwest, and so therefore, when that information is updated, then Minnesota as a state has lost Title I funding as a result of that, and there's about 12 states that are in a similar situation as Minnesota. In the past, before 2004, Minnesota was always able to get a fix because it was basically two states with the problem, Minnesota and Massachusetts. But when it became far more states, Congress wasn't as interested in fixing the problem. We've seen more stabilization of our Title I funding over the past 3 years. Shortly after No Child Left Behind was reauthorized, we did see some precipitous drop in funding because of that change in the census data. But it's not necessarily just a matter of poverty, but it's also a matter of the census data and our population growth.
And with respect to the income data, now it's very early because the ink is new and dry on this yet. Are we seeing some of the policies that are in the stimulus package weighting the benefits towards more of the poor and low-income states versus high-income states like Minnesota, or is it just too early to know that yet?
Commissioner Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I haven't done an analysis of other states. We're just trying to sort of tackle Minnesota and what we're going to get. I will say that it's the stabilization fund share is based on the relative, how many school-age children you have, ages 5 to 24, and then your relative population of states. So it doesn't really put into consideration poverty. It's really based on your population count. The Title I formula is meant to try to direct funds to high-need schools. That's the basis for the act. But I will say, as we talked about in an earlier discussion with Representative Marquardt, the Title I formula is not distributed the same as our general education formula. So you will see a disproportionate number of schools that are poverty receive more money under a Title I formula than, say, the basic, just the basic formula that we have in place without categoricals. So I know it's a long answer to a question, but it's based on a lot of factors and not just poverty.
Thank you. And then, members, the handout that you just got, we have our Johnny on the spot vice chair, who's happened to have in his packet an article about the state of Maryland that I was talking about. So he has asked the pages to pass it out just so members have that in hand. Thank you, Representative Ward. All right. Dr. Melcher?
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher of the Department of Education. Just one additional note on Representative Garofalo's question, just to get a bottom line statistical figure there. New information coming out every day on the bill, and the Department of Education has now published the figures, at least the preliminary estimates, and what they're showing, if we combine all the education money, Minnesota would be getting $1,134,000,000 out of a total of about $77 billion. So we're getting $1.1 billion out of $77 million, but we haven't done any analysis in terms of how that relates to our overall population or other sorts of factors. The next piece that we'd like to talk about is the special education funding included in the stimulus package, and that is the second largest piece of the overall program after the state fiscal stabilization fund. What this money is doing is essentially increasing the current federal allocations that we receive under the IDEA program, and just thought it would be helpful to give you a little bit of background on how we spend the current allocation, because essentially the new money is going to be more of the same. It'll be for additional dollars for the same purposes as we can currently spend dollars. So this is the program that started in 1975. It's always helpful to remind you that this program is designed to help ensure that all children with a disability have access to a free, appropriate public education, and that the federal government initially authorized federal funding for up to 40% of the national average excess cost of special education. We've never reached anything close to that, and I'll give you a little bit of information about what this bill would do to that in the short term. The current allocations to Minnesota under the federal special education law are in three pots. There is the big pot is Part D, Section 611, which pays for education for children 3 to 21. We're currently getting $180 million in that. There's a Part B, Section 619, which is a preschool program for 3 to 5-year-olds. We're getting $7.3 million. And under the Part C, which is a birth to two piece, we're getting about $7 billion. The new allocations, this is a two-year allocation, look very similar to what we're currently getting, except that it's a two-year number. So basically what this is doing is increasing our federal special ed funding by about 50% for a two-year period. So we'll be getting an extra $189.8 million in the Part B, Section 611. And actually, just in today's updates, the $3.2 million number has now become $7.3 million, and the $5.8 million for Part C is $7 million. So numbers are still moving around, but generally speaking, the amounts we're getting as an increase are pretty comparable to what we're currently getting. But since it's spread over 2 years, it basically becomes essentially a 50% increase in the current level of federal special education funding. From what we can tell so far, and we're still waiting for further guidance, the standard rules for how school districts must use federal special education funding will apply to these increases in IDEA funding under the stimulus bill. So, for example, the new money must be used to fund the excess cost of special education. There's a maintenance of effort requirement. Part of the existing maintenance of effort requirement is that there's a 50% rule, which I will describe in a little bit more detail later, but essentially allows a school district that's received an increase to use 50% of the increase in the first year only to essentially count that as local funds toward their maintenance of effort obligation. In other words, they can supplant the 50%, and the other 50% needs to essentially be for new spending relating to special education. There's also a tidings amendment, which essentially gives the school districts 27 months to obligate the funds that they get. So they're spending the dollars over a little bit longer than a two-year period. This chart shows the historical pattern in terms of federal support for special education as a percentage of the excess cost of special education. As I indicated, in 1975, the federal legislation authorized the federal government to cover 40% of the cost of special education, of the excess cost. We've never been close to that. Back in 1998, we were about 9%. Currently, we're at about 15%. This new money would raise the federal contribution to something close to about 24% for a two-year period, and then, absent any further federal funding, it would drop back down to about 15%.
I read in the paper today, but obviously it was wrong, that this new money would put us up to the promised share from the federal government, but I guess not.
Madam Chair, not according to the numbers that I've got. And again, it's very important to note this is a two-year period, and after the 2 years is up, unless there's another federal bill that puts more money into this, we're back where we were before. So there's some issues about using one-time money for permanent issues. So how do we allocate the federal special education funding? There's a three-part formula. Currently, we have a $55 million base allocation. The federal government changed the way they allocate federal special education aid back in 1999. Prior to that, the funding was allocated based on the number of special education students you had in your district. Beginning in 1999, the federal government moved more to a census-based formula, and they grandfathered in the amount of money that was paid under the old formula back in 1999. So we currently get $55 million. It's a frozen amount. The money is allocated based on the 1998 child count, and if you have a school district where we have had new charter schools come in since 1999, the money gets divvied up between the charter schools and the school district based on the current enrollment of special education students between the school district and the charter school. So if you have a Minneapolis or a St. Paul, they're still getting the same total amount of money they got back in 1999, but now they're dividing it up between the school district and the charter school based on that population.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meltzer, a thought just occurred to me. With the maintenance of effort issues, if this two-year appropriation comes in and school districts spend this money on the excess cost of special education as is determined by the bill, and then that money goes away, will school districts be facing an increased cross-subsidy burden to maintain that level of effort?
Mm-hmm.
Or will the maintenance of effort requirements drop them back down to where it is now? Is there any sense of that?
Dr. Meltzer.
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I will go into a maintenance effort discussion in a little more detail later, but I think the short answer to your question is that the federal maintenance of effort calculations are based on state and local contributions. So the fact that there is more federal dollars coming in would not affect the state maintenance of effort requirement, except for this 50% rule, which I'll explain in a moment. But what it does create a situation if school districts use these dollars to hire more special education teachers, for example, and then the money runs out after 2 years, we're in a situation where either school districts would have to reduce the level of services while still providing FAPE, or there'll be a larger cross-subsidy, or the state would be left backfilling with an increase in state special education aid. So it really does create an issue for us 2 years down the road, but I don't think it's a maintenance of effort issue. It's more the same sort of issue you have with a lot of federal programs where there's startup money, you got the money for a couple of years, and then what do you do when the new money runs out? Do you keep the program going with either state or local money, or do you accept that we're not going to do this anymore?
Before we go on, members, we're going to do a couple of housekeeping things. First of all, Representative Dietrich, could you move the minutes, please, from February 17th? Madam Chair. Representative Dietrich moves the minutes of February 17th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And then the second thing, I was thinking we had committee tomorrow, but we don't because we have those hearings starting up. So I want to pass around another Get Well card. We seem to be full of surgeries in this committee. We still haven't reclaimed Representative Benson. And now our own Greg Crow is going out for surgery. Is it today or tomorrow? Today. And so when I found the card for Representative Benson, I knew about Mr. Crow, so he's getting the same card because it's perfect for politicians and people that work at the legislature. We took a vote, you should get well soon, and so forth. So we're going to pass it around for you all to sign. For Mr. Crow, he hopes to be back in about a week. And in the meanwhile, he said we could email him, and I said no one had better dare to do it. So, all right, thank you, and excuse me, please go ahead, Dr. Meltzer.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, I was explaining the current method that we allocate federal special education funding through, and the first part of that is this base funding level of $55 million that's basically grandfathering in the level of funding we got in 1999. The second and third parts of the current federal allocation formula are allocating the increase over the base, which is currently about $108 million, 85% based on the total pre-K-12 enrollment in the school district, including the non-public enrollment, and then 15% based on poverty. And we have chosen to use the free and reduced lunch count as our measure of poverty for allocating the special education dollars among school districts. So currently $92 million is going out based on total enrollment, and $16 million is going out based on poverty. So now we get to the new money. So the new money does not affect that base piece, which is based on the child count from 1998. All of that $94 million is going out based on the second two parts of the formula. So 85% of the new money would go out based on the total enrollment in the school district, including the non-public schools that are located there, and 15% based on the free and reduced lunch count, the same as our as any other increase we would receive in federal special education aid from year to year. The new money can only be used to pay the excess cost of providing special education, and it must be used to supplement, not supplant, state and local funds, again with the exception I discussed earlier. Uses of federal funds can include special education staff, contracted services, staff development, supplies, equipment, early intervening services, which is limited to 15% of the money, kind of the federal equivalent of RTI, and the money cannot be used to cover the unreimbursed costs of staff funded with state categorical funds. So in other words, you can't say we're covering 68% of the salary with state money and we're going to backfill with the federal dollars. We can't use the federal money for that purpose. As far as maintenance of effort goes, we have two different federal requirements. First, we have the state maintenance of effort requirement, and included in your packet there is a one-page spreadsheet with fairly small type which describes our calculation of state maintenance of effort. Essentially, what the federal government requires is for us to take a look at all of the state money that goes for special education, including our special education aid, excess cost aid, some of the smaller categorical aids, and also what our state agencies spend directly, Caribou Academy, Department of Corrections, and so forth, and come up with what the total amount of money that the state is contributing to special education. And what we're required to do from year to year is to spend at least as much as we spent the year before, or if we have declining enrollment of special education students, we can reduce that on a percentage basis. But we have not experienced a decline in special education students. We've had increases. So therefore, our maintenance of effort requirement essentially becomes, what did we spend for special education last year at the state level? And then we're still required to spend that again this year. So we could not take the extra $94 million of federal special ed money and say we're going to reduce the state special ed so that we're still spending that same total. This is a maintenance of effort requirement that we're required to fulfill. And what you can see is we have met our federal requirements each year. We were just barely over the limit in 2006. We only exceeded the minimum by $430,000 that year. And you can see in fiscal year 2008, we exceeded the minimum by $161 million because of the large increase provided by the 2007 legislature. But that does permanently increase the base then for our future maintenance of effort calculation. So that's the state level maintenance of effort fees.
And at least then for this one, Rep. Marquardt, your fear doesn't have to come true. Thanks to the federal government. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, and then the second piece of maintenance of effort is the local maintenance of effort. And here, what we're looking at is part of the school district spending. And in doing that calculation, we look at what are they spending from state and local money, excluding federal special education dollars. And this is where the 50% rule applies. And just to explain the 50% rule a little bit, a school district can use up to 50% of the increase in their federal aid from one year to the next as if it were state and local funds. So in other words, if you get another $100 of federal aid for special education for that first year only, you can treat $50 of that as if it was a local contribution and basically reduce your effort by that amount for one year. But then the year after that, if you don't get another increase, then you're back to where you started.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, Ms. Milcher, how come under the cross-country special education, there's nothing listed after 2005, fiscal year 2005?
That's
right. Madam Chair and Representative Ward, the special education cross-subsidy was a special legislative appropriation that was helping to reduce the cross-subsidy. It was a categorical aid that the state
gave. Yep. Thank you.
We still have a cross-subsidy, but it's a different...
Yep.
Okay. So just to give you a quick example of how the 50% rule would work, if, for example, the federal funds were providing $200 in fiscal year 2009 and state and local funds were providing $1,000 in 2009, and then in 2010 we got a 50% increase, which is essentially what we're looking at here, and the federal money went from $200 to $300, the 50% rule would say that you could use 50% of that $100 increase, or $50, and treat that as state and local funds. So the state or the school district could reduce its effort from $1,000 down to $950 for that one year. But then the following year, since there wasn't another increase, it's always based on what the new money is that year, not the historical over a base. There's no new money coming in 2011 because we're getting another $94 million from the feds in 11. We also got $94 million in 10, so there's no increase between 10 and 11. Therefore, the school district would have to go back to that base of $1,000. And so, in effect, what the increase does is it could provide the school district some flexibility on the use of those funds, but only for the first year. Another issue that's come up in terms of federal special education funding is that in the most recent update of IDEA, there's a provision that allows school districts to use up to 15% of their federal special education dollars for early intervening services, which is a kind of a parallel with what we do here with alternative delivery with RTI. So with more federal dollars in the mix, school districts could choose to use more money, including 15% of that increase, for early intervening services. However, there is a caveat that if they are choosing to use some dollars under the 50% rule and treating those as local funds, you can't use that dollar twice. It can only be, you have to choose between the 15% for EIS or the maintenance of effort waiver for that particular year. There are some exceptions to local maintenance of effort requirements. If the school district has a reduction in the number of students with disabilities, they can reduce their special education spending proportionately. If they have a change in status of a high-cost student, for example, they have a student that's costing them $80,000 a year, they graduate or moves out of the district, they can have an adjustment for that. If they eliminate a one-time expenditure, they had maybe a major equipment purchase one year and that was not recurring, that can also be an adjustment. And also, if there's voluntary departure of staff or departure for just cause while the district is documenting that it maintains FAPE. So the federal maintenance of effort is not a hard and fast rule on the district. There are some exceptions here, but by and large, the school district is going to have to spend the same amount for special education from state and local money as it spent the year before. The Tidings Amendment is another provision that relates to the use of federal dollars for special education and other federal dollars, and essentially requires the funds to be obligated over 27 months and expended within 30 months. So if we're getting another $94 million of federal special education money for fiscal year 2010, the school districts kind of have that assigned to them. They can choose to spend that over 2+ years. So it's not all going to have to go out the door in 1 year. It really provides kind of a 3-year period of time when we look at an increase of $94 million in 2010, another increase of $94 million in 2011. The district really has until December 31st of 2011 to spend that increase from 2010, and then they have another year to spend the increase from 2011. So it's really kind of a 3-year window that they could use that expanded federal money for rather than a 2-year because of the carryover provisions in the Tidings Amendment.
Dr. Meltzer, are those exceptions that are on slide 31, are those currently allowed or is it just for this new money?
Madam Chair, those are currently allowed, and we go through that calculation each year. The department analyzes for each district whether they've maintained efforts, and we do have to get correspondence from school districts each year if they have a situation where they're not maintaining effort, but they can explain that it's because we had a high-cost kid move out. So they have to send us a letter and document that. So we do have that. We very rarely had any school districts that did not maintain effort. The penalty for not maintaining effort is we take money out of your general education aid and send it to the federal government, and most people don't like to do that. But we did have one charter school a couple of years ago that did fail to maintain effort, and we had to send a check for about $20,000 to the federal government. They do not allow us to pay a penalty by reducing the federal aid. We have to take it out of our state general education aid to restore that. So it's a serious issue, but it rarely occurs.
Thank you. Rep. Ben Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Meltzer, under the Tidings Amendment, a school district could not just bank this money in their fund balance. They have about 2 school years to spend it, but then it's going to go away, and whatever they spend it on, they will either have to stop doing or find state or local funds to replace what the federal funds were doing.
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, that's correct. It's essentially 2.5 years to actually get it out the door to have actually spent the money. And what we currently do is about 24 months into the period, we send a notice out to districts that have not spent a fair share of their money, and we have a process whereby we reallocate to other school districts in order to avoid having to give it back to the federal government. There is a process in federal law where the school district, if they know they're not going to spend it and they voluntarily turn that back to us, then we can reallocate that to other Minnesota districts that are spending the money. And we do some of that each year, and that might increase with this sort of a sizable increase in the federal special education dollars.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, other funding, as noted in the stimulus bill, Head Start will receive an increase of $20.6 million. This is an estimate. These funds flow directly to the local providers. It does not go through the Department of Education or the Department of Human Services. Additionally, there's $100 million available to states and local eligible entities for impact aid. That's traditionally aid for public schools located on reservations.
Well, and Madam Chair, I'd like to add on the impact aid piece that money, I believe, is designated for school construction, and so we will be in touch with Red Lake and other districts that may have issues to ensure that they're aware of this and are making an application. There's no guarantee they would get money that's competitive, but we'd like them at least to think about it since we know there are some needs there.
It would be good to have someone else paying for Red Lake, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Dietrich has a
Thank
question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Meltzer, I have a question about the Tidings Amendment also. It says that the funds becoming available in year 2010, does that include the 2009-2010 school year, or are we, or was this just an example, and is none of this going to affect 2009 school year, the beginning of the 2009 school year?
Dr. Meltzer.
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, the Tidings Amendment always applies to the existing level of spending. So we do have that 27-month rule that applies to federal funds that came in during fiscal year 2009 as well. But this is this is the example for the new money that's coming out now. The state fiscal year 2010 would be the 2009-2010 school year. So a school district could use that money during the 2009-2010 school year. They could use it during the 2010-2011 school year, or any time until really December 31st of 2011. So they really have parts of three fiscal years they could spread that over.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the school construction funding, do you know if, for example, school districts have been bonding for existing school construction, if those funds can be used to supplement the bond payments on those, or does it have to be a new construction?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I do not believe that they can use the money for existing construction. I have not studied that in depth, though. We would have to probably do some checking. I know there are some specific things that you can use the money for, so there's some expectation that there will be projects approved under this, and I don't think that covers existing debt. I think it's for new construction projects. I think that the concept of the bill being they're going to stimulate new construction that wouldn't otherwise be occurring.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to add some new reporting, general reporting requirements for the state. As part of this bill, the department will be required to report on the use and distribution of funds, which is pretty straightforward, the number of jobs saved and created under these provisions, the tax increases averted because of these funds, progress in reducing inequity in the distribution of highly qualified teachers, implementing the state longitudinal data system, developing valid and reliable assessments for ELL students and students with disabilities. The state will also have to report tuition and fee increases imposed and any actions taken to limit these increases to students. In addition, we'll have to report the extent to which public institutions of higher education maintained, increased, or decreased enrollment of in-state students, including students eligible for financial aid. And also, this one might be probably quite lengthy for school districts and the state, probably mostly for school districts, the description of each modernization, renovation, and repair project funded, which must include the amounts awarded and project costs.
Okay, that concludes the PowerPoint. I have one question on slide 34, the progress in reducing inequity in the distribution of highly qualified teachers. Is that for Minnesota? Would that be QComp, or are we looking at how to get them in? What would you think would be in our plan for that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is part of the Title II piece of No Child Left Behind about highly qualified teachers. Right now, Minnesota's about 96% of Minnesota teachers are considered highly qualified under the Act, which is the highest in the nation. And so in terms of that provision, we're pretty well positioned. Within that provision, we are supposed to report on the inequity of highly qualified teachers in high need schools versus schools that are not in high needs, and trying to, the idea behind the Act was trying to get more experienced and qualified teachers in some of our highest need schools. The state does have somewhat of an inequity in that piece. And we do have a plan, particularly with our two urban school districts, Minneapolis and St. Paul, to try to remedy the situation. But it's not a situation that is what we would call dire. It's something that we're working with our local school districts, and particularly our urban school districts, to improve those percentages. We are expecting the federal government to audit our Title II portion of the No Child Left Behind Act. They've audited other areas, Title I, our statewide assessments. Now they're coming in on the highly qualified provision. So we've had a lot of efforts in the last 6 months to try to make sure that school districts are hiring licensed teachers and they're highly qualified under the No Child Left Behind Act. And so I think we're pretty well positioned, and we've shown improvements in this area. We have the highest percentage in the nation of teachers highly qualified, and I think we're well positioned to demonstrate we can meet that assurance.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. If these funds are going to be available in 6 months for the start of the next school term, at what point will school districts have a pretty good idea as to how much they will have available so they can start planning on adding staff or whatever with these funds?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Secretary of Education is required to send the money to states within 60 days. We have to get it out within 120 days. We're already making preparations and working with our school districts to prepare for that. The first item is just knowing how much money they're going to receive under the plan. So first, what we'll have to do is, as part of the governor's budget revisions, recommend how the at least the State Stabilization Act funds will be allocated. We'll also have to finalize the special education portions and the Title I portions that will go to school districts. That does not require the governor to submit its specific plan because it's formulaic. It's nothing we can really change. It's all part of the data. And so we expect that over the next course of the next month that school districts will have a really good idea of how much money they will receive, and then they can set their budgets in April accordingly and sign contracts with teachers and staff.
Okay. Any questions from any other members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, on the new reporting requirements, and I'm assuming when it says new reporting requirements, this is these are requirements that have never been reported by the department yet, correct?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, that's correct. We report how much money we spend. We do not report as to specifically detailed how local school districts spend the money. Local school districts will report it to us in what's known in our through our EDRS and UFAR system. So we're just going to have to make sure that districts are reporting that accurately to the state because that is unaudited data, so it tends to be less as precise. And then we'll have to report that to the federal government. But we do not have guidance yet as from the U.S. Department of Education as to how it, we will report the information or what the requirements will be.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So will this be able to be handled with within the department with the current staff?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we will do what we can to make this work. As you've probably seen in previous presentations, we're down a lot of staff, probably almost 100 since 2001. That's create significant burdens on us as we look at the requirements, but we're not about to not implement it and turn away substantial money for schools. So we're prepared and we're making preparations to ensure that this money does get out and we meet all of the reporting requirements by the federal government.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other members with questions? If not, I will ask a question. Could you, we'll start with Ms. Anderson and then we'll see what, how Dr. Melcher would, I would like you both to critique the pluses and minuses of getting this federal stimulus money. Of course, we're all going to want to take it, and we need to, we have such a huge deficit, but could you also talk about, you know, what are the, so the pluses are maybe more obvious, but could you critique the pluses and minuses of getting this money for K-12 education?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a good question. Obviously, we're not going to say we're not happy to have additional funds for schools. This is a tough time for the state and school districts. The State Stabilization Fund, I think, will help, if we can get some of the details worked out, will at least provide a bridge, I think, for the next 2 years. Real specific concerns have to do with special education. We have tried, when the bill was reauthorized in 2004, to gain more flexibility, and the result was the 50% rule. We wanted more than that. We would have liked to see seen a lot more flexibility in the use of funds in special education. I think it's going to be very difficult, as brought up in this committee, for school districts to spend all of that money because it's going to obligate them to greater services, and there's no guarantee that that money will be available after the 2 or 3 years that they have to spend that special education money. So I think from the greatest minus of the bill as it relates to education provisions is the special education piece. And I think we're going to be in a position where we may not spend all of that money unless Congress either decides to permanently appropriate the money for school districts in the future or provides greater flexibility.
And I at least asked that question of my congresswoman, and I wanted some sort of hope that that might continue on, or some portion might continue on, or some sort of hope. And we did not get any promise at all in that regard. So, thank you. Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, I'm reluctant to say too much about this, but I would just say that my personal feeling is that we've got some one-time dollars here that are being allocated for ongoing needs, and it would have been preferable, I think, to have had a little more flexibility in terms of using this more for some of the one-time infrastructure kinds of things that were clearly one-time. I think this is going to create some challenges for us in a couple of years when the dollars run out.
Thank you. And we, I serve on the Early Childhood Committee, too, some of us do, and we noticed that, there was so much one-time money that the legislature was working with last year, and they started some programs, and now the one-time money is gone. So I think that is a real issue. So thank you. Any other questions? Where is that card? Down, it made it there. Okay. Representative Dietrich.
Yes.
We're going to keep the meeting going until at least the card is signed.
This is probably a real naive question, but in some of that special ed money, since the concern is down the line, maintenance of efforts type spending, what if, is there any flexibility in that money to get around that so that you're not hiring people and then providing more services? Let me just give you an example. Like, if you invested in special education technology to more effectively and efficiently provide special education services, but you weren't hiring a person or providing another program that brings more children in, how would something like that, would that fall into that whole maintenance of effort pool?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, that's a very good point. I think back on slide 26, we talked about the different things that you can use federal special education dollars for, and equipment is one of those purposes. So, for example, if a school district had an aging bus fleet that was relating to special education, you might use some of that special education dollars to replace a special education vehicle. That might be, it's not a permanent thing, but it's a longer term kind of investment, or other sorts of equipment that needs to be. There's certain limits on how far you want to take that, but that might be a way, try to find one-time things to use the money for and not so much ongoing. But the problem is that most of the cost is staff, and that's an ongoing expenditure, and if you use the money to add more staff, you've got the issue of, what do you do in 2 years when you no longer have the federal money and you either need to then cut staff or replace it with state money or replace it with more cross-subsidy money? And that gets to be an issue, and especially if districts are struggling with cuts in their general education program and at the same time adding staff in the special education area, that can create some hard feelings within the school district in terms of the level of services provided to all of the students that the school board has to serve.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Dietrich.
When I was asking the question, I thought about even that rapid response, rapid recovery type testing system, for special education or something like that, would be great to implement with some of that money, because, once again, that's not extra staff necessarily. It's just a different way of delivering services. And so I would like to just make sure that you understand is that if we end up in that situation where we feel like we can't maintain spending, so we would not accept it, that we have a lengthy opportunity to figure out how can we more efficiently and effectively implement special education services without adding staff.
And of course, a large part of the stimulus package is to have jobs, so I'm surprised that they are even allowing equipment and supplies, because if we don't have we don't continue to have people working, then we don't get the economy stimulated and get the taxes coming in again. But yet, if we earn back money, then it would certainly be better to make those kind of investments rather than have to turn it back. So I'm glad they gave us a little flexibility. Members, the card is signed, but we'll go until 4:15 if we have that many questions. Representative Garofalo.
Oh, I'm not going to go until 4:15. Just regarding Representative Dietrich's question, these are school district decisions, right? And these aren't, we don't do this, right? Mr. Melcher?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, that's correct. This is really, the way I look at it is we have an ongoing federal special education program. And what the federal government is doing here is increasing the level of funding for 2 years by about 50%. And The money goes to the local school district, and they make a choice as to how they will be spending that within their overall requirement to provide a free appropriate public education to children. So they're making decisions on staffing, contracting, et cetera.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Grosswell. And Dr. Melcher, will any of these funds be received by June 30th of this year?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I am not positive. I know there's discussion here about the 60 days and 120 days, and I'm thinking that this is fiscal year 2010 money as opposed to current fiscal year money. And I think maybe the stabilization dollars are more targeted to the current fiscal year. I think the special ed money is more targeted to fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11, but I may be mistaken on that.
And
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, leads me to my final question, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. I think we're upside down right now for this current fiscal year, not the upcoming biennium, but this current year. I think we're upside down 153 right now, at least, where revenues are below forecast since November. We're minus 153. The forecast is going to come out in less than 2 weeks, and I think it's a safe bet we're going to be north of 300 or 400 million for this biennium. And I'm wondering, as a committee, are we going to be talking at all about things we're going to have to do for this biennium to fix things? Because I don't know how the governor can unallot that amount of money. The money's all out the door. Everything's gone, so he's going to need legislative. We're going to need some sort of legislative action, not the upcoming biennium, but for right now. And are we planning on having any hearings on things we may do or at least may not do to talk about that?
Representative Garofalo, as you know, we're starting hearings around the state tomorrow night and all day Friday, and then in the evenings next week. And so we're gathering input from what citizens might want to say. Unfortunately, we have, you know, such changing circumstances that the governor's plan is, you know, already out of date because we have the federal stimulus package and then the deficit is growing. But that's as good as we have to go on. And I think a large part of the answer to your question is what are legislators willing to do and what is the public willing to ask us to do. And so until we get that answer, it's hard to answer your question. You know what I would prefer, and that would be to come up with some more funding so we aren't looking at all these cuts in our budget. I don't think we should be cutting very much of anything out of education, which our state economist says is our key to productivity. Education, jobs, productivity, all tied up. And if we had been investing in education as we ought, then we would be hopefully have been an outlier in the good way, like Minnesota usually is when there's deficits like this. We haven't been, and so now we're in the soup with all the other states around the country and the Midwest instead of being a good outlier. So I would like us to get into the position of being standing out as really supporting the new Minnesota miracle and investing in our schools and our students. You gave me a softball, Representative Garofalo. It's so great. You must have been talking to
me. That's not what I asked you, though. It's a great answer, but it's not.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to.
Representative Garofalo?
Not to push the point, but just so members are aware, I don't know how the governor can unallot this problem. As in previous sessions, the governor has unallotted and took care of this, and we've been able to keep our hands clean. There's going to need to be some legislative action for this fiscal year. Forget the upcoming biennium and the June 30th deadline in May. For this biennium, we're in upside down right now. That's going to get worse. We are actually going to have to do something. And I haven't heard any conversations about that, and I don't know if members know that. And it just might be, maybe for a half hour in one committee hearing, it might be an option for us just to discuss things that we potentially can do, because the LGA payments are out the door.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Let me throw this one to Commissioner Anderson. The last time we had unallotments at K-12 education was left unscathed. And so since the governor has been spending a lot of time talking about prioritizing education, that he did not cut education in the face of a huge deficit education, he's asking for more money. So I think Representative Graff was right for other budgets, and of course we don't know what the legislatures are going to do. It might not be following along the path of the governor, but I've been going in a very hopeful way for education finance, at least. But if the governor is going to be unallotting in education, then we certainly want to be involved, and we have to be involved because we're in session. He can only unallot without us when we're not here. So is that fine?
No. He can unallot.
He can unallot even when we're in session? Well, I thought it was only when we were not in session, and so if he can do it while we're here, I still think he would want some, if he were going to unallot in education, he would want some cover, and he would want us to help out with that. So let's ask Commissioner Anderson, do you think in the face of the growing deficit, the governor will be unallotting current funding for this biennium, this fiscal year, in as a result of the growing deficit?
Madam Chair, I'm not going to speculate as to what he will do or not do. This is sort of a question higher up to Commissioner Hansen. But I will say that I think that they have a process they've worked out at the leadership level, and it worked the first time on the unallotments, and if the unallotments need to occur, I'm sure that leadership will work with the governor and the governor's office on a sort of agreed upon parameters and such. So I'll leave that to people higher up to figure out. But we always, you know, we need to be, we're very aware at the state level that the budget deficit will likely grow in this fiscal year and in the next two fiscal years. So we're just hoping that we can avoid reductions to K-12 education and hold education harmless. That's our goal.
Thank you very much. And so with that advice, Representative Garofalo, I haven't been interested in spending a lot of time on how we're going to cut education when we have the governor protecting us like this. But if he starts to decide to unallot, we are going to definitely have hearings. We don't want that done without us, and we'll certainly participate. Representative McFarland.
This is just a brief comment, but when we talk about the supply, the federal money going for supplies and equipment, we have to remember that these are not just teaching jobs, but we have companies that are producing, manufacturing the equipment, the buses and things like that, that money would go for. So it would be jobs in other areas.
Thank you, Representative McFarland. Point well taken, and we had a wonderful hearing in the policy committee yesterday organized by Representative McFarland on business input, and so it's not unsurprising that you would give that input here today. So thank you very much. Anybody else? Otherwise, we will adjourn. The meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.